Welcome to the weekly podcast of Science and the City, the webzine of the New York Academy of Sciences, online at scienceandthecity.org. Today is March 3rd, 2006, and I'm Adrienne Burke. Ever since Darwin put forth his theory of natural selection, the field of evolutionary biology has been trying to explain how animals developed their astounding variety and complexity. The standard answer has been that small genetic mutations accumulate over time to produce wondrous innovations such as eyes and wings. In their new book, The Plausibility of Life, Mark Kirschner and John Gerhardt employ the latest research in genetics and biology to offer a new explanation. Their theory of facilitated variation describes how small random genetic change can be converted into complex, useful innovations. Kirschner, the founding chair of the Systems Biology Department at Harvard Medical School, spoke recently at the New York Academy of Sciences.
Every year, dozens of books come out about evolution. They're primarily written for lay audiences, and they tell a similar story over and over with wonderful examples. They tell the story of descent with modification, namely that animals over time have spread out over the earth into various habitats with a divergent lineage from a single source. They tell the story of natural selection, and they take us on a world tour to the rocky outcroppings of the Galapagos, the verdant jungles of the Indian subcontinent, and the isolated archipelagos of the Pacific. Here we see Darwin's theory in action, where the forces of nature mold the diversity of life into amazing adaptations through the struggle for survival. There is another set of books that you can also find in the evolution section of your local bookstore. They challenge Darwin. Their goal is to undermine his theory by pointing out so-called gaps and raising questions about the plausibility of creation by natural selection. As with the lay books on Darwinian evolution, these books are also not meant particularly for the scientific community, who rightfully recognize Darwin's preeminent place in the history of science. So where does our new book fall? The Plausibility of Life, Resolving Darwin's Dilemma, which I co-wrote with John Gerhardt from UC Berkeley. It can also be found in the same evolution section. But its goal, if not its audience, are quite different. Our objective was neither to praise Darwin nor to bury him. Rather, we challenged Darwin in the name of buttressing the theory of evolution. There are gaps in Darwin's theory. How could there not be? He wrote before we knew about chromosomes, DNA, embryonic development, and cell structure, and almost everything else we learned in high school biology. The question for us is, can all the knowledge that we have gained from modern biological research be now brought to bear on Darwin's theory to produce new insights that address any of these gaps? In our book, we argue the answer is yes, and that modern biology, arising mainly from laboratory experiments during the past 25 years, can form the basis for a more complete theory of evolution. So why has it taken so long to reconcile the molecular and cellular biology with evolution? Part of the problem has been the way biological research has been conducted over the last century. It has followed two rather different paths. The first path is the most obvious, and it has been with us throughout human history. It is something that every culture has addressed. What is the origin of the diverse life forms on our planet? Stated in modern evolutionary terms, how can we explain how animals have been able to acquire new forms and functions over the course of evolution, such as eyes or hands or beaks? We all started with that question in our youth when we went to zoos, to aquaria, to botanic gardens. We hiked in the woods and we watched the birds or simply marveled at the complexity of our own bodies. This fascination with variation reached its peak in the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. Kings had collected for many years exotic animals into menageries where we gawked at them with fascination. But with the advent of the scientific approach to taxonomy came the rise of zoological parks. Then came the grand natural history museums of the world, filled with specimens gathered from organized expeditions to the far corners of the earth. The goal here was to study, to document and to celebrate life in all its diverse forms. But another kind of science was developing around the same time that was drawing a very different conclusion about life. Cell biology and embryology were finding extraordinary similarities when they looked closely at the variety of the natural world, not differences. As microscopy progressed, we saw the same cell structure, the same cell types, the same organelles in the wide expanses of life. As chemistry developed into biochemistry, we found that the chemistry of all life was nearly the same. One cannot look at a protein and tell whether it came from a flea or a whale. One cannot easily distinguish the chemistry of DNA from bacteria or from cows. As we looked at life at higher and higher resolution, we found it looks more and more the same. This search for the universal composition of life and the universal processes in life is reminiscent of the experiences of physics and chemistry. After all, the late the 19th and early 20th century were eras of thermodynamics, atomic theory, electricity and magnetism, and quantum theory. The last 150 years have also been kind to this approach in biology as well. We have seen the universal laws of heredity embodied in a single molecule, DNA. We have seen a universal model of cell structure involving lipid membranes, a universal model of metabolism, a universal code for making proteins. Less universal, but still parsimonious, are the cell nucleus, meiosis and mitosis, the cell compartments in eukaryotic cells. Most of what is in a biology textbook, or even the leading biological journals, is about the universal features of life. So where does that leave us? Two paths of science, one extolling the variety of life, the other obsessed with its universal properties. Herein lies a paradox. How can this immense variation arise from this universality? Reconciling this paradox was, in fact, a major goal of our book. Now, it's a paradox, but we all know it has to have an answer, because the diversity of life has to be conveyed by the common biological mechanisms that we have discovered. This paradox was never a comfortable one. Sewell Wright, one of the troika of great thinkers who founded population genetics in the early 20th century, saw that no explanation could ever be complete about evolution without considering cellular mechanisms. He criticized those who focused only on gross anatomy and wrote, quote, "The older writers on evolution were often staggered by the seeming necessity of accounting for fine details, for example, the fine structure of all the bones." But he goes on to say that structure is never inherited as such, but merely the types of adaptive cell behavior which lead to particular types of structure. This was both an odd and prophetic statement. Wright, of course, was guessing that there were not going to be genes for traits, but instead genes that instructed cells how to create those traits, long before developmental biology was even close to such an explanation. To understand evolution, he argues, one must understand these cellular mechanisms and the ease with which they could change. At the same time, one must recognize that there are limits on what these mechanisms can do. For example, to understand the evolution of vertebrate limbs, there must be something special or limiting about the number of digits. After all organisms today have five digits, or fused digits, which are essentially made from five digits. And the number of limbs is always a maximum of four, never five or six or eight. Yet these limits are hardly very constraining, generating everything from a whale's flipper to Arthur Rubinstein's hand. So another luminary in evolution came at this paradox from the opposite direction. Theodosius Dobzhansky, a former professor at Columbia and Rockefeller and at Caltech, argued that our understanding of cellular mechanisms depended on our understanding of evolution. In a famous epigram in 1973, he wrote, Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. That is what we argue in the book. Yet many of our colleagues give evolution very little thought. After all, most of the great accomplishments in biology in the past 50 years have been made completely independently of any consideration of evolution. We've made sense out of metabolism, we've made sense out of the physical basis of heredity, sense out of gene regulation, cell biology of secretion, the cytoskeleton, nerve conduction, developmental biology, and most recently, sense out of the organization of the genome. Today, most students that I see in graduate school at Harvard have never taken a course in evolutionary biology, and most do not see a reason why they should. They look at evolution as an elective interest, such as music, comparative religion, or fine arts. They would certainly not agree that they need evolution to make sense out of biology. What Sewell Wright seemed to be saying is that we need to understand the organism to understand evolution. And what Theodosius Dobzhansky was saying is that we need to understand evolution in order to understand the organism. John Garrett and I think they are both right, and that the field of biology with all its disciplines can now come together to explain how conserved universal processes generate the astounding variation of phenotype, and hence the title of our book, The Plausibility of Life. Part of the answer for how variety arises comes, of course, through genetic mutations. But that is only part of the answer for a very simple reason. We don't have very many genes. This was made abundantly clear and surprised many of us in the year 2000 with the publication of the draft human genome sequence. Only about 22,500 genes in the human being. Only about 50% more genes than we have in a fruit fly. Or only 6 times the number of genes that the simplest free-living bacterium has. Now about 80 or more different animal genomes have been sequenced, and we find another surprising result. Not only are there very few genes, but many of them are the same from one organism to another. The human being, 15% of the human being's genome sequence, genes, are found in bacteria. 25% are found in single-cell fungi. 50% are found in fruit flies, and 70% are found in the frog. So the question burns, how does all this diversity come out of such a limited diversity of genes? This is what we mean by Darwin's dilemma. Now, Darwin, of course, did not know about genes, but he did know that there had to be some way to explain how variety was generated and inherited. He thought, and in fact most of us are taught, that natural selection is the driving force in evolution. But natural selection, again, is only part of the equation. In our book, John and I assert that Darwin's theory is based on 3 pillars. The first of these pillars is natural selection, Darwin's great accomplishment. It conceives of a world of struggle in which individuals in populations vary and differ in how effectively they can contribute their progeny to the next generation. But this, of course, means you need a means of inheritance, or else there would be no progressive change over time. Darwin knew this. He guessed at a theory of inheritance. It's best forgotten because it was completely wrong. The second pillar is the modern theory of heredity, begun by Gregor Mendel with his pea breeding experiments, and obviously reaching some sort of climax in the discovery of DNA, and the appreciation that there is a common and simple form of inheritance in all of life. But this raises another question. How do you go from the blueprint of life to a completed structure? And when there is a change in the sequence of DNA, this must be somehow reflected in a change in the structure. How does that occur? Therefore, there is need for a third pillar, a theory of how changes in genes lead to variety upon which natural selection can act. It is to explain this third pillar that John Garrett and I have formulated what we call a theory of facilitated variation. Facilitated variation explains how readily phenotypic change can be generated in response to genotypic change. It reflects the way biological systems are built. A core idea of facilitated variation is that parts of the biological system are highly constrained and do not change during evolution. But these constrained parts have certain properties that deconstrain and hence facilitate variation in other components. In aggregate, we claim that overall variation is increased, and this variation is of a type that is particularly useful, primarily because it is non-lethal. Now, Darwin didn't consider constraints at all. According to Stephen Jay Gould, Darwin's most brilliant accomplishment was his recognition that variation had to meet three criteria: that it was copious in extent, small in deviation from the mean, and isotropic, that is, random in its direction. We're talking now about phenotypic variation. But Gould was troubled by these assumptions, and so are we. Yet Darwin's criteria still forms the basis of how we think about evolution. Following on Darwin, many biologists might say, life is like a lump of modeling clay, incredibly plastic, and able, due to the accrual of many small changes, to go in virtually any direction. We now know this is formulation of life is simply wrong. Modern biological research has exposed in breathtaking detail an architecture of life that does not resemble modeling clay, but rather more something like Lego blocks, where the individual components are constrained, but there's a large variety of structures that can be readily built and assembled from similar parts. The large number of conserved genes across the species in itself argues for this interpretation. Yet before we knew how small was the actual number of genes in our genomes, the staggering similarities on a molecular level between different organisms made the modeling clay seem unreasonable, as an example. As genetics grew as a field in the early 20th century, it seemed plausible and, in fact, likely that each trait in each life form was directed by a different gene. The one gene, one enzyme hypothesis of George Beadle and Edward Tatum in 1940, for which they won the Nobel Prize, encapsulated this notion. But they were not evolutionary biologists. Their idea that each step in metabolism is regulated by a different protein, a different enzyme, that is encoded in a different gene, works for metabolism, but cannot be extended to the processes that generate the variation we study in evolution of animals and plants. But yet this is still how we teach evolution, even though anyone who knows anything about development and cell biology knows that this is wrong. And definitive proof that this is wrong, as if we needed it, came with the realization that the number of genes, even from the most complex life forms, are few in number and highly conserved. But even before we knew about genes, it should have been obvious that there must be major constraints in evolution from looking just at the gross anatomy of body plans of life on Earth. As we travel down the branches of the tree of life, we see on a macroscopic level increasing constraints in all directions, from the bilateral body plan, the limited and conserved number of cell types, to the process of sex. But even though science has shown that genetic variation is random, phenotypic variation cannot be random, because you can only change what already exists. And that is why you never see vertebrates with six limbs or three eyes. Therefore, one should not think of variation as isotropic or random, but rather biased by what structures already exist. Facilitated variation argues that this bias, rather than being limiting, greatly enables evolutionary change. How does facilitated variation work? Let's start with an analogy that demonstrates how constraint can increase the likelihood of favorable outcomes. Imagine, if you will, a monkey trying to write the word monkey. You give him a Bic pen or a Mont Blanc pen and a piece of paper, and he will produce random lines and scratches, but never anything even resembling the word monkey. But give him a typewriter, and there'll be a real possibility that he can pound out the requisite 6 letters in the right order in about 10 years, assuming 1 keystroke per second, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The typewriter constrains the motor actions of the monkey to make only letters. So you can't make other things with a typewriter. You can't draw beautiful pictures. And letters at least have a chance to be useful. Most pen scratches do not. Now let's constrain the monkey even further by giving him a modern computer that's programmed with an automatic spelling corrector so that it produces random English words. Then the chances escalate so that he may produce the monkey in less than a day. More constraint equals more useful outcomes. Now let's leave the analogies behind and look at biology itself from the same conceptual point of view. Let's consider one of the great triumphs of vertebrate evolution, the evolutionary modification of the limbs, as varied as the wings of an albatross, the hooves of an antelope, the claws of a tiger. At first glance, these limbs look extraordinarily complex. Some people might even say irreducibly so. To function, they have a precise construction of bone, muscle, nerve, and blood vessels. Each of these tissues must work in complete concert for the limb to function. Thus, creating these novel forms would seem to be very difficult by random processes alone. But when one looks at this from the point of view of facilitated variation, with our modern understanding as a foundation, the complexity melts away. What is left is a coordination of conserved processes that are highly adaptive and facile in situations that require change. So how do bones, muscles, nerves, and blood vessels get together in the right organization? It's actually quite ingenious, simple, and forgiving. All structure starts with the bone and cartilage. This is the frame on which everything else hangs. Muscles act on the bones, the nerves control the muscles, and the vascular system provides food and oxygen and removes waste for all of the tissues. The development of the limb follows roughly the same order. Bones form as condensations of mesoderm according to a plan set out by selector genes such as Hox genes. Once the bones are in place, muscle cells migrate from the flank into the limbs with no preconceived plan. They take their position solely in relation to the bone. If one experimentally transplants a limb bud to a new location, muscle cells will still enter that tissue and organize themselves in the transplanted limb. For the development of the nervous system, both the sensory and motor parts, nerve axons grow out into the periphery, randomly looking for muscle cells to innervate. If they find them, they will form synapses, and the very process of synapse formation will stabilize the nerve cell bodies. If the motor axons don't find appropriate targets, for example, if they grow into non-muscle tissue, they fail to receive a trophic signal, and the nerve cells die. For the development of the vasculature, blood vessels enter the limb, sprouting from existing vessels, using as their cue for direction and extent of growth the state of hypoxia of the tissue. They also have no preset plan. One only needs to look at the pattern of veins in your right and left arms to see how they differ even in a single body with the same genetic composition. The blood vessels literally seek out areas that need oxygen, and the vessels grow rather randomly and develop depending on demand. Such a system can also vary physiologically during growth. It can hypertrophy during exercise, and it can atrophy during inactivity. It remains always responsive, not only during development. Consequently, the processes by which muscles, nerve, and blood vessels grow is highly conserved in vertebrates. Yet they can easily rearrange themselves to create new limbs for evolution. What seemed like a difficult task of construction involving several simultaneous parts is actually quite simple to achieve and, we dare say, plausible. Now, the study of evolution has sought to explain complexity, a complexity that at times seems impossibly daunting. And we all know the examples, how to explain a flower, how to explain the human brain, how to explain the heart, how to explain the eye. But yet rather than explain each beak, brain, lung, and placenta as separate questions, we must look at the underlying generative mechanisms, what Sewell Wright called the adaptive cell behaviors. Thankfully, biologists around the world have been doing just that without even knowing it. Our book is a tour of modern biological research from the viewpoint of evolution. What we are offering are not new experiments or new data, but a reinterpretation of settled and well-understood biological phenomena as applied to the central problem, still confounding a complete theory of evolution: how genetic variation, which is random, leads readily to the extraordinary adaptations in life. In doing so, we elevate the individual organism from a passive target of natural selection to a central player in the 3 billion history of evolution. So in writing this book, what audience do we have in mind? Our primary concern was to bridge the divide between the molecular sciences and evolutionary biology. We believe that a modern reformation of the theory of evolution lies in mixing the greatest insights of the two disciplines. Therefore, our hope is that we can inspire our fellow molecular and cell biologists to start thinking about the implications of their work for evolution, and to acquaint those already thinking about evolution with the newly acquired understanding of the processes of development that determine how phenotypic variation is produced from genotypic change. We quickly found that to reach both groups, it was necessary to remove as much jargon as possible and to focus on the conceptual issues. But this created an opportunity that we never thought was possible: to open these complex ideas to the motivated lay reader who had maybe some background in biology. In fact, we believe that looking at biology from the viewpoint of evolution is a useful approach to making sense of the immense material emerging from biological research today. We start our book with a major modern justification for refuting Lamarck's view of inheritance of acquired traits, and we give the modern evidence that genetic variation is random, or nearly so. That sets up the question of how random genetic variation is converted into non-random phenotypic variation, the foundation of our theory of facilitated variation. In the subsequent chapters, we spell out the four key mechanisms that give facilitated variation its power to facilitate. In the end, we deal with the modern evidence for facilitated variation and the theoretical reasons why facilitated variation should ever have evolved as a property of the organism in the first place, and why it is maintained in biological systems. The first major mechanism underlying facilitated variation, and I say the book is really about these mechanisms taken from all over biology, it's filled with a lot of examples. The first major mechanism returns to the deep relationship between processes that enable physiological variation, such as homeostasis, and processes that are modified in evolution to generate new anatomy and physiology. So we were trying to bring together physiological variation and evolutionary variation. Now, the last person to really do this got in trouble. because this would is, in fact, the relationship between physiological change, such as the growth of the body, and evolutionary change, such as the growth of the giraffe's neck, was Lamarck's grand idea, and has been discredited by arguing that it's impossible to convert physiological change into genetic change. We accept the notion, of course, that evolutionary change requires mutation, but we point out that much of evolutionary change involves the selection or stabilization of extant physiological plasticity. That is, that the target of a lot of mutational change in evolution are physiologically plastic mechanisms. This is hardly a new concept and is thoroughly compatible with Darwin's view. What has changed in our eyes is that we do not point primarily to physiological processes that involve adaptations to the outside environment as being most important, although they still are. We point mostly to physiological processes that the organism uses in its embryonic development. For example, embryonic development is replete with cell types that have multiple options and ranges of options, such as the neural crest, which can form cartilage, nerve, pigment, etc. Thus, changes in beak shape, pigmentation, or jaw structure can easily occur by changing the time and extent of a process rather than creating a new process. The second mechanism that we discuss in great detail is something that we call weak linkage. It is explained by the prevalence of mechanisms in biology that are built to readily reconfigure inputs and outputs. The key to such systems is that very complex processes are poised to respond to very simple signals that can call forth these processes. This occurs over and over. Transcription is a very complex process leading to gene expression, but in some cases, a few changes of a few nucleotides can bring in a whole new form of regulation that changes the time, the amount, or the circumstances in which a gene is expressed. A few nucleotides, for example, can change whether a gene is under the control of the estrogen hormone or the glucocorticoid hormone. And this small change brings to bear the massive, complex machinery of gene expression and function. In the early days of experimental embryology, Hans Spemann found that a few cells can send a signal in the amphibian embryo which can elicit an entire pathway of development of the body plan, generating the entire central nervous system from the belly epidermis. By just transplanting a few cells to the belly, he was able to generate a whole new frog from that belly epidermis. Most embryologists speculated that the signal must be of high information content to pattern the entire brain and spinal cord. In the end, when these signals were finally identified in the 1990s, they turned out to be simple inhibitors. The cells of the embryo are multipotent at the early stage of development, and they are globally inhibited. Any cell is prepared to make the brain. Its inhibition only has to be we only have to compromise that global inhibition locally, even in very nonspecific ways, to generate a complex organ like the brain. Since it's very, very easy to generate inhibitors in biological systems, complex new functions can be locally mobilized with little mutational change. The third mechanism we discuss is what we call exploratory processes. We've already seen these in my discussion of the limb formation, those migratory muscle cells that take their position relative to the bone, those migratory nerve axons and blood vessel cells. Their defining property is that in normal function of the body, they generate structures by first generating many potential structures and then selecting on them functionally. This means in normal development, many unused configurations may be produced before a functional one is found and selected. Although this produces unwanted states, these states may yet find new usefulness in evolution. It's hard sometimes to recognize these exploratory systems. Variation and selection is the hypothesis of last resort for many biologists. And it took many, many years before this unlikely scenario was accepted as the mechanism underlying adaptive immunity. Yet it is pervasive in the cytoskeleton, in tissue morphogenesis, and in many aspects of behavior. The fourth mechanism we call compartmentalization. The multicellular organism is divided into many invisible compartments that each have a unique set of transcription factors and secreted signals to define them. These are set up just after early development, when there are a few thousand cells. They are invisible because these compartments do not correspond to anatomical features, but they can be visualized with special stains for the RNA and protein products. These compartments endow every gene that responds to them with a special address that can modify the activity of that gene. In some cases, it modifies the extent of the activity. In some cases, it completely inhibits it or activates it. And in some cases, it completely changes the response of that gene in terms of its response to other signals. By this means, the organism has liberated itself from a requirement that each gene has to operate the same way in each anatomical region. This is a great liberation. Mutations that might be beneficial to the heart but detrimental to the brain can still occur because there's different regulation in the two tissues. We see this very often, such as the very different size of the forelimb and the hind limb of kangaroos. This is probably just a local quantitative adjustment with considerable phenotypic consequences. Why do the processes of living organisms seem so predisposed to being non-lethal when they are modified by mutation? And why would they be miraculously biased to have some appropriateness to new selective conditions? This is, you know, maybe the strongest statement one can make about facilitated variation. There are several strong arguments, but they must address the expectation that these processes of facilitated variation must serve some current use in the organism. They can't be retained because the organism might think, gee, this might come in handy 100 billion years from now. Otherwise, Darwinian selection should have weeded them out. The simplest and strongest argument is that in multicellular organisms, the same few genes must be reused in many different contexts. Even just to make a not very complex multicellular organism, you require versatility and combinability. Once you have perfected processes that can generate different states, such as cell types, in the same organism with a limited number of genes, you have created processes that can easily generate new states in new organisms. For example, the fruit fly, Drosophila, can specify precisely the position of each of the 5,000 bristles on its cuticle, each one specifically determined by genetic circuitry using a limited number of genes. This system can easily be respecified to generate new arrangements. A similar argument explains why you get such non-lethality and appropriateness for new selection. The organism is physiologically adaptable, and as I've said, most of the adaptability plays out in embryonic development, where cells receive signals and generate alternative responses. We predict that most of the changes that generate new anatomies and new physiologies in evolution involve simple regulatory changes to existing developmental processes. These processes themselves have built-in feedback control, and in such circumstances, change when it is made is embedded under many controls that limit its lethality. If we come back to the point raised by Sewell Wright, evolution cannot be understood without a basic understanding of how genetic variation produces phenotypic change. Selection is only a sieve that selects these changes. It does not produce them. Biology today is in a very strong position to complete Darwin's brilliant theory. Facilitated variation is a marshaling of data that is well established, but now we should focus it on the question of how novelty arises. If we come back to Theodosius Dobzhansky's quote, that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, the organism can be seen now as a great generative engine converting mutational change into phenotypic change. This capacity of the organism should be thought of as part of its phenotype. We should be looking for how this is achieved. Evolution has told us where to look for how this is produced, the types of changes that are most easily generated, and the places in pathology, for example, in cancer, where these same adaptive cellular systems go awry. A late colleague of mine, who was a great crystallographer, not an evolutionary biologist, but a very much a fan of these ideas as we were generating them, said that facilitated variation in evolution would, in the end, be the only way we can teach biology. And any other approach would seem like an arbitrary selection of just so stories. What he meant is that when one considers the organization of biology along the lines of how it serves evolution, one can appreciate the structure of life with a unified view. After all, life itself, in its very complexities, arose through evolution. By teaching biology in terms of a narrative of unfolding evolution, one can appreciate how form serves function and consequently the great advances of modern biological research. Squaring the universality of biological processes with the diversity of life will have some real-world applications. What is medicine, after all, but the challenge of reconciling what makes us similar with what makes us different? If we were all the same, then a cure for one would be a cure for all. This, unfortunately, is obviously not the case. As with evolutionary biologists, doctors must deal with genetic diversity within a population and the environmental complexities that individuals in this population encounter. In both the scientific and lay presses, we hear about an upcoming revolution in personalized medicine. In order for this to work, we must understand the physiological plasticity that is also at the heart of facilitated variation. One can also imagine how a more nuanced understanding of the robustness of life could help us turn back the tide on mass extinctions and other environmental problems. I would like to say one final thing about the book and my co-author, John Gerhardt. In our backgrounds, we span biology from enzymology to cell biology to developmental biology. Like many, we were initially dazzled by the similarities, the deep similarities in all of life. And ultimately, we're seduced by its variety. In the end, it has come as a relief and some satisfaction to know that the functional properties of the core processes of life, those that are so highly conserved, can resolve the seeming paradox of conservation and diversity. Not exactly what Darwin or we would have expected. The three pillars needed for Darwin's overall theory of evolution, which I explained earlier, are in different states of completion. Darwin himself in the 19th century made his great contribution by proving by example the theory of natural selection. This has been confirmed by everything from laboratory experiments to plant and animal breeding to the variation selection that is bedeviling us today in pathogenic microbes. Mendel and the modern geneticists of the 20th century established the second pillar required for Darwin's theory, that of heredity. Today, it is thoroughly proven for all of life, down to atomic detail. The third pillar of how non-random variation in the organism is generated from random mutation is today's and tomorrow's task. Though initiated by questions in evolution, it will help us understand the structure of the organism, the consequences of genetic diversity in populations, and the limits of robustness in organisms that leads to aging and disease. We believe by the end of this century, Dobzhansky's quote will seem self-evident for all who study and appreciate biology. Nothing in the field will ever make sense, but except in the terms of evolution.
To find out about all that's happening at the intersection of science and culture, visit our website at scienceandthecity.org.